Side 10. Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with The Note for the Disaster of the Gloddenfields on page 271. Yavanie, Ivanith, thus corresponded to Halimoth, our September, and Narbeleth to our October. 40 days, till Narbeleth 15, was sufficient, if all went well. The journey was probably at least 308 leagues as marched. But the soldiers of the Dunedain, tall men of great strength and endurance, were accustomed to move fully armed at 8 leagues a day, with ease. When they went in 8 spells of a league, with short breaks at the end of each league, Lar, Sindarin, Daur, originally meaning a stop or pause, and 1 hour near midday. This made a march of about 10.5 hours, in which they were walking 8 hours. This pace they could maintain for long periods with adequate provision. In haste, they can move much faster, at 12 leagues a day, or in great need, more, but for shorter periods. At the date of the disaster, in the latitude of Imladris, which they were approaching, there were at least 11 hours of daylight in open country, but at midwinter, less than 8. Long journeys were not, however, undertaken in the north between the beginning of Hithui, Hisime, November, and the end of Ninue, Nenime, February, in time of peace. Author's note. A detailed account of the calendars in use in Middle-earth is given in Appendix D to The Lord of the Rings. End of note. At the east gate of the bridge on a bright morning, Meneldil bade him farewell. Note 10. Meneldil was the nephew of Isildur, son of Isildur's younger brother Anarion, slain in the siege of Barad-dûr. Isildur had established Meneldil as king of Gondor. He was a man of courtesy, but far-seeing, and he did not reveal his thoughts. He was, in fact, well pleased by the departure of Isildur and his sons, and hoped that affairs in the north would keep them long occupied. Author's note. It is stated in unpublished annals concerning the heirs of Elendil that Meneldil was the 4th child of Anarion, that he was born in the year 3318 of the Second Age, and that he was the last man to be born in Numenor. The note just cited is the only reference to his character. End of note.
Go now with good speed, and may the sun of your setting out not cease to shine on your road.
With Isildur went his 3 sons, Elendur, Aratan, and Kirion, and his guard of 200 knights and soldiers, stern men of Arnor and war-hardened. Note 11. All 3 had fought in the War of the Alliance, but Aratan and Kirion had not been in the invasion of Mordor and the siege of Barad-dûr, for Isildur had sent them to man his fortress of Minas Ithil, lest Sauron should escape Gil-galad and Elendil and seek to force a way through Cirith Duath, later called Cirith Ungol, and take vengeance on the Dunedain before he was overcome. Elendur, Isildur's heir and dear to him, had accompanied his father throughout the war, save the last challenge upon Orodruin, and he was in Isildur's full confidence. Author's note. It is stated in the annals mentioned in the last note that Isildur's eldest son was born in Numenor in the year 3299 of the Second Age. Isildur himself was born in 3209. End of note. Of their journey nothing is told until they had passed over the Dagorlad and on northward into the wide and empty lands south of Greenwood the Great. On the 20th day, as they came within far side of the forest crowning the highlands before them with a distant gleam of the red and gold of Ivanith, the sky became overcast, and a dark wind came up from the Sea of Rune, laden with rain. The rain lasted for 4 days, so when they came to the entrance to the vales between Lorien and Amon Lank, Isildur turned away from the Anduin, swollen with swift water, and went up the steep slopes on its eastern side to gain the ancient paths of the sylvan elves that ran near the eaves of the forest. Note 12. Amon Lank, Naked Hill, was the highest point in the highland at the southwest corner of the Greenwood, and was so called because no trees grew on its summit. In later days, it was Dol Guldur, the first stronghold of Sauron after his awakening. Author's note. End of note. So it came to pass that late in the afternoon of the 30th day of their journey, they were passing the north borders of the Gladden Fields, marching along a path that led to Thranduil's realm as it then was. Note 13. The Gladden Fields, Loig Ninglaron. In the elder days when the Sylvan Elves first settled there, they were a lake formed in a deep depression into which the Anduin poured from the north down the swiftest part of its course, a long descent of some 70 miles, and there mingled with the torrent of the Gladden River, Seer Ninglor, hastening from the mountains. The lake had been wider west of Anduin, for the eastern side of the valley was steeper, but on the east it probably reached as far as the feet of the long slopes down from the forest, then still wooded, its reedy borders being marked by the gentler slope, just below the path that Isildur was following. The lake had become a great marsh, through which the river wandered in a wilderness of islets, and wide beds of reed and rush, and armies of yellow iris that grew taller than a man, and gave their name to all the region, and to the river from the mountains, about whose lower course they grew most thickly. But the marsh had receded to the east, and from the foot of the lower slopes there were now wide flats, grown with grass and small rushes, on which men could walk. Author's note. End of note. Note 14. Long before the War of the Alliance, Orifair, king of the Sylvan Elves east of Anduin, being disturbed by rumors of the rising power of Sauron, had left their ancient dwellings about Amon Lank, across the river from their kin in Lorien. 3 times he had moved northwards, and at the end of the Second Age he dwelt in the western glens of the Emmon Duer. And his numerous people lived and roamed in the woods and vales westward, as far as Anduin, north of the ancient Dwarf Road, Men Enaugrim. He had joined the Alliance, but was slain in the assault upon the gates of Mordor. Thranduil, his son, had returned with the remnant of the army of the Sylvan Elves in the year before Isildur's march. The Emmon Duer, Dark Mountains, were a group of high hills in the northeast of the forest, so-called because dense fir woods grew upon their slopes, but they were not yet of evil name. In later days, when the shadow of Sauron spread through Greenwood the Great and changed its name from Erin Galen to Taur Nufuin, translated Mirkwood, the Emmon Duer became a haunt of many of his most evil creatures and were called Emmon Nufuin, the Mountains of Mirkwood. Author's note. On Orifair, see Appendix B to the History of Galadriel and Celeborn. In one of the passages there cited, Orifair's retreat northwards within the Greenwood is ascribed to his desire to move out of range of the dwarves of Khazad Dûm and of Celeborn and Galadriel in Lorien. The elvish names of the Mountains of Mirkwood are not found elsewhere. In Appendix F, 2, to The Lord of the Rings, the elvish name of Mirkwood is Taur Eendaidalos, Forest of the Great Fear. The name given here, Taur Nufuin, Forest Under Night, was the later name of Dorthonion, the forested highland on the northern borders of Beleriand in the elder days. The application of the same name, Taur Nufuin, to both Mirkwood and Dorthonion is notable, in the light of the close relation of my father's pictures of them. See Pictures by J.R.R. Tolkien, 1979. Note to number 37. After the end of the War of the Ring, Thranduil and Celeborn renamed Mirkwood once more, calling it Erin Lasgallen, the Wood of Green Leaves. Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings. Men Enaugrim, the Dwarf Road, is the old forest road described in The Hobbit, Chapter 7. In the earlier draft of this section of the present narrative, there is a note referring to the ancient forest road that led down from the pass of Imladris and crossed Anduin by a bridge that had been enlarged and strengthened for the passage of the armies of the Alliance, and so over the eastern valley into the Greenwood. The Anduin could not be bridged at any lower point, for a few miles below the forest road the land fell steeply, and the river became very swift until it reached the great basin of the Gladden Fields. Beyond the fields it quickened again, and was then a great flood fed by many streams, of which the names are forgotten save those of the larger, the Glotten, Sir Ninglor, Silverlode, Celebrant, and Limlight. In The Hobbit, the forest road traversed the great river by the old ford, and there is no mention of there having once been a bridge at the crossing. End of note. The fair day was waning. Above the distant mountains, clouds were gathering, reddened by the misty sun as it drew down towards them. The deeps of the valley were already in gray shadow. The Dunedain were singing, for their day's march was near its end, and three parts of the long road to Imladris were behind them. To their right, the forest loomed above them at the top of steep slopes, running down to their path, below which the descent into the valley bottom was gentler. Suddenly, as the sun plunged into cloud, they heard the hideous cries of orcs, and saw them issuing from the forest, and moving down the slopes, yelling their war cries. Note 15. A different tradition of the event is represented in the brief account given in Of the Rings of Power, The Silmarillion, page 295. Isildur was overwhelmed by a host of orcs that lay in wait in the misty mountains, and they descended upon him at unawares in his camp between the greenwood and the great river, nigh to Loig Ninglaron, the Gladden fields, for he was heedless and set no guard, deeming that all his foes were overthrown. End of note. In the dimmed light, their number could only be guessed, but the Dunedain were plainly many times, even to 10 times, outnumbered. Isildur commanded a Thangeil to be drawn up, a shield wall of 2 serried ranks that could be bent back at either end if outflanked, until at need it became a closed ring. If the land had been flat, or the slope in his favor, he would have formed his company into a deer knife and charged the orcs, hoping by the great strength of the Dunedain and their weapons to cleave a way through them and scatter them in dismay. But that could not now be done. Note 16. Thangeil, shield fence, was the name of this formation in Sindarin, the normal spoken language of Elendil's people. Its official name in Quenya was Sandastan, shield barrier, derived from primitive Thanda, shield, and Stama, bar, exclude. The Sindarin word used a different second element, Kayo, a fence or palisade of spikes and sharp stakes. This, in primitive form Kegla, was derived from a stem, keg, snag, barb, seen also in the primitive word Kegya, hedge, whence Sindarin Kai. Compare the Morgai in Mordor. The deer knife, Quenya Nerneta, man spearhead, was a wedge formation, launched over a short distance against an enemy massing but not yet arrayed, or against a defensive formation on open ground. Quenya Nete, Sindarin knife, was applied to any formation or projection tapering to a point. A spearhead, gore, wedge, narrow promontory, root, neck, narrow. Compare the knife of Lorien, the land at the angle of the Celebrant and Anduin, which at the actual junction of the rivers was narrower and more pointed than can be shown on a small-scale map. Author's note. End of note. A shadow of foreboding fell upon his heart. "The vengeance of Sauron lives on, though he may be dead," he said to Elendur, who stood beside him. "There is cunning and design here. We have no hope of help. Moria and Lorien are now far behind, and Thranduil 4 days' march ahead, and we bear burdens of worth beyond all reckoning," said Elendur, for he was in his father's confidence. The orcs were now drawing near. Isildur turned to his esquire, Ottar, he said. "I give this now into your keeping," and he delivered to him the great sheath and the shards of Narsil, Elendil's sword. Note 17. Ottar is the only name used in the legends, but it is probably only the title of address that Isildur used at this tragic moment, hiding his feelings under formality. Ottar, warrior, soldier, was the title of all who, though fully trained and experienced, had not yet been admitted to the rank of Roquin, knight. But Otar was dear to Isildur and of his own kin. Author's note. End of note.
Save it from capture by all means that you can find, and at all costs, even at the cost of being held a coward who deserted me. Take your companion with you and flee. Go, I command you.
Then Otar knelt and kissed his hand, and the two young men fled down into the dark valley. Note 18. In the earlier draft, Isildur directed Otar to take two companions with him. In Of the Rings of Power, The Silmarillion, page 295, and in The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-2, it is told that three men only came ever back over the mountains. In the text given here, the implication is that the third was Estelmo, Elendur's esquire, who survived the battle. See pages 275 and 276. End of note. If the keen-eyed orcs marked their flight, they took no heed. They halted briefly, preparing their assault. First they let fly a hail of arrows, and then suddenly with a great shout they did as Isildur would have done, and hurled a great mass of their chief warriors down the last slope against the Dunedain, expecting to break up their shield wall. But it stood firm. The arrows had been unavailing against the Numenorean armor. The great men towered above the tallest orcs, and their swords and spears far outreached the weapons of their enemies. The onslaught faltered, broke, and retreated, leaving the defenders little harmed, unshaken, behind piles of fallen orcs. It seemed to Isildur that the enemy was withdrawing towards the forest. He looked back. The red rim of the sun gleamed out from the clouds as it went down behind the mountains. Night would soon be falling. He gave orders to resume the march at once, but to bend their course down towards the lower and flatter ground, where the orcs would have less advantage. Note 19. They had passed the deep depression of the Gladden Fields, beyond which the ground on the east side of Anduin, which flowed in a deep channel, was firmer and drier, for the lie of the land changed. It began to climb northwards, until as it neared the forest road and Thranduil's country, it was almost level with the eaves of the greenwood. This Isildur knew well. Author's note. End of note. Maybe he believed that after their costly repulse they would give way, though their scouts might follow him during the night and watch his camp. That was the manner of orcs, who were most often dismayed when their prey could turn and bite. But he was mistaken. There was not only cunning in the attack, but fierce and relentless hatred. The orcs of the mountains were stiffened and commanded by grim servants of Barad-dûr, sent out long before to watch the passes. And though it was unknown to them, the ring, cut from his black hand 2 years before, was still laden with Sauron's evil will and called to all his servants for their aid. Note 20. There can be no doubt that Sauron, well informed of the alliance, had sent out such orc troops of the Red Eye as he could spare, to do what they could to harry any forces that attempted to shorten their road by crossing the mountains. In the event the main might of Gil-galad, together with Isildur and part of the men of Arnor, had come over the passes of Imladris and Caradhras, and the orcs were dismayed and hid themselves, but they remained alert and watchful, determined to attack any companies of elves or men that they outnumbered. Thranduil they had let pass, for even his diminished army was far too strong for them. But they bided their time, for the most part hidden in the forest, while others lurked along the river banks. It is unlikely that any news of Sauron's fall had reached them, for he had been straitly besieged in Mordor, and all his forces had been destroyed. If any few had escaped, they had fled far to the east with the Ringwraiths. This small detachment in the north, of no account, was forgotten. Probably they thought that Sauron had been victorious, and the war-scarred army of Thranduil was retreating to hide in fastnesses of the forest. Thus they would be emboldened and eager to win their master's praise, though they had not been in the main battles. But it was not his praise they would have won, if any had lived long enough to see his revival. No tortures would have satisfied his anger with the bungling fools who had let slip the greatest prize in Middle-earth, even though they could know nothing of the One Ring, which, save to Sauron himself, was known only to the 9 Ringwraiths, its slaves. Yet many have thought that the ferocity and determination of their assault on Isildur was in part due to the ring. It was little more than 2 years since it had left his hand, and though it was swiftly cooling, it was still heavy with his evil will, and seeking all means to return to its lord, as it did again when he recovered and was rehoused. So it is thought. Although they did not understand it, the orc chiefs were filled with a fierce desire to destroy the Dunedain and capture their leader. Nonetheless, it proved in the event that the War of the Ring was lost at the disaster of the Gloddenfields. Author's note. End of note. The Dunedain had gone scarcely a mile when the orcs moved again. This time they did not charge, but used all their forces. They came down on a wide front, which bent into a crescent, and soon closed into an unbroken ring about the Dunedain. They were silent now, and kept at a distance out of the range of the dreaded steel bows of Numenor, though the light was fast failing, and Isildur had all too few archers for his need. Note 21. On the bows of the Numenorians, see the description of Numenor, page 170. End of note. Note 22. No more than 20, it is said, for no such need had been expected. Author's note. End of note. He halted. There was a pause, though the most keen-eyed among the Dunedain said that the orcs were moving inwards, stealthily, step by step. Elendor went to his father, who was standing dark and alone, as if lost in thought. Atarinya, he said. What of the power that would cow these foul creatures and command them to obey you? Is it then of no avail?
Alas, it is not, Senya. I cannot use it. I dread the pain of touching it.
Note 23. Compare the words of the scroll which Isildur wrote concerning the ring before he departed from Gondor on his last journey, and which Gandalf reported to the Council of Elrond in Rivendell. It was hot when I first took it. Hot as a gleed. And my hand was scorched, so that I doubt if ever again I shall be free of the pain of it. Yet even as I write, it is cooled, and seemeth to shrink. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-2. End of note.
And I have not yet found the strength to bend it to my will. It needs one greater than I now know myself to be. My pride has fallen. It should go to the keepers of the three.
At that moment there came a sudden blast of horns, and the orcs closed in on all sides, flinging themselves against the Dunedain with reckless ferocity. Night had come, and hope faded. Men were falling, for some of the greater orcs leaped up, two at a time, and dead or alive with their weight bore down a Dunedain, so that other strong claws could drag him out and slay him. The orcs might pay 5-1 in this exchange, but it was too cheap. Kirion was slain in this way, and Aratan, mortally wounded, in an attempt to rescue him. Elendor, not yet harmed, sought Isildur. He was rallying the men on the east side, where the assault was heaviest, for the orcs still feared the Elendilmir that he bore on his brow, and avoided him. Elendor touched him on the shoulder, and he turned fiercely, thinking an orc had crept behind.
"My king," said Elendor, "Kirion is dead, and Aratan is dying. Your last counselor must advise, nay, command you, as you commanded Otar. Go! Take your burden, and at all costs bring it to the keepers, even at the cost of abandoning your men and me."
"King's son," said Isildur, "I knew that I must do so, but I feared the pain, nor could I go without your leave. Forgive me and my pride that has brought you to this doom."
Note 24. The pride that led him to keep the ring against the council of Elrond and Círdan that it should be destroyed in the fires of Orodruin. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-2, and of the Rings of Power, in the Silmarillion, page 295. End of note. Elendor kissed him.
"Go! Go now!" he said.
Isildur turned west, and drawing up the ring that hung in a wallet from a fine chain about his neck, he set it upon his finger with a cry of pain, and was never seen again by any eye upon Middle-earth. But the Elendilmir of the West could not be quenched, and suddenly it blazed forth red and wrathful as a burning star. Men and orcs gave way in fear, and Isildur, drawing a hood over his head, vanished into the night. Note 25. The meaning, sufficiently remarkable, of this passage appears to be that the light of the Elendilmir was proof against the invisibility conferred by the One Ring when worn, if its light would be visible were the ring not worn. But when Isildur covered his head with a hood, its light was extinguished. End of note. Of what befell the Dunedain, only this was later known. Ere long, they all lay dead, save one, a young esquire, stunned and buried under fallen men. So perished Elendur, who should afterwards have been king, and as all foretold who knew him, in his strength and wisdom, and his majesty without pride, one of the greatest, the fairest of the seed of Elendil, most like to his grandsire. Note 26. It is said that in later days those, such as Elrond, whose memories recalled him, were struck by the great likeness to him, in body and mind, of King Elessar, the victor in the War of the Ring, in which both the Ring and Sauron were ended forever. Elessar was, according to the records of the Dúnedain, the descendant in the 38th degree of Elendur's brother Valandil. So long was it before he was avenged. Author's note. End of note. Now of Isildur it is told that he was in great pain and anguish of heart, but at first he ran like a stag from the hounds until he came to the bottom of the valley. There he halted, to make sure that he was not pursued, for orcs could track a fugitive in the dark by scent, and needed no eyes. Then he went on more warily, for wide flats stretched on into the gloom before him, rough and pathless, with many traps for wandering feet. So it was that he came at last to the banks of Anduin at the dead of night, and he was weary, for he had made a journey that the Dúnedain on such ground could have made no quicker, marching without halt and by day. Note 27. 7 leagues or more from the place of battle, night had fallen when he fled. He reached Anduin at midnight, or near it. Author's note. End of note. The river was swirling dark and swift before him. He stood for a while, alone and in despair. Then in haste he cast off all his armor and weapons, save a short sword at his belt, and plunged into the water. Note 28. This was of a kind called ekket, a short stabbing sword with a broad blade, pointed and two-edged, from 1 foot to 1.5 feet long. Author's note. End of note. He was a man of strength and endurance that few even of the Dúnedain of that age could equal, but he had little hope to gain the other shore. Before he had gone far, he was forced to turn almost north against the current, and strive as he might, he was ever swept down towards the tangles of the Gladden fields. They were nearer than he had thought, and even as he felt the stream slacken and had almost won across, he found himself struggling among great rushes and clinging weeds. Note 29. The place of the last stand had been 1 mile or more beyond their northern border, but maybe in the dark the fall of the land had bent his course somewhat to the south. Author's note. End of note. There, suddenly he knew that the ring had gone, by chance, or chance well used. It had left his hand, and gone where he could never hope to find it again. At first, so overwhelming was his sense of loss, that he struggled no more, and would have sunk and drowned. But swift as it had come, the mood passed, the pain had left him. A great burden had been taken away. His feet found the riverbed, and heaving himself up out of the mud, he floundered through the reeds to a marshy islet close to the western shore. There he rose up out of the water, only a mortal man, a small creature lost and abandoned in the wilds of Middle-earth. But to the night-eyed orcs that lurked there on the watch, he loomed up, a monstrous shadow of fear, with a piercing eye like a star. They loosed their poisoned arrows at it, and fled, needlessly, for Isildur, unarmed, was pierced through heart and throat, and without a cry he fell back into the water. No trace of his body was ever found by elves or men. So passed the first victim of the malice of the masterless ring, Isildur, second king of all the Dúnedain, lord of Arnor and Gondor, and in that age of the world the last. The sources of the legend of Isildur's death. There were eyewitnesses of the event. Otar and his companion escaped, bearing with them the shards of Narsil. The tale mentions a young man who survived the slaughter. He was Elendur's esquire, named Estelmo, and was one of the last to fall, but was stunned by a club and not slain, and was found alive under Elendur's body. He heard the words of Isildur and Elendur at their parting. There were rescuers who came on the scene too late, but in time to disturb the orcs and prevent their mutilation of the bodies. For there were certain woodmen who got news to Thranduil by runners, and also themselves gathered a force to ambush the orcs, of which they got wind, and scattered. For though victorious, their losses had been great, and almost all of the great orcs had fallen. They attempted no such attack again for long years after. The story of the last hours of Isildur and his death was due to surmise, but well-founded. The legend in its full form was not composed until the reign of Elisar in the Fourth Age, when other evidence was discovered. Up to then, it had been known, firstly, that Isildur had the ring and had fled towards the river. Secondly, that his mail, helm, shield, and great sword, but nothing else, had been found on the bank not far above the Glodden fields. Thirdly, that the orcs had left watchers on the west bank, armed with bows to intercept any who might escape the battle and flee to the river, for traces of their camps were found, one close to the borders of the Glodden fields. And fourthly, that Isildur and the ring, separately or together, must have been lost in the river. For if Isildur had reached the west shore wearing the ring, he should have eluded the watch. And so hardy a man of great endurance could not have failed to come then to Lorien or Moria before he foundered. Though it was a long journey, each of the Dunedain carried in a sealed wallet on his belt a small phial of cordial and wafers of a waybread that would sustain life in him for many days. Not indeed the Miruvor or the Lembas of the Eldar, but like them, for the medicine and other arts of Numenor were potent and not yet forgotten. Note 30. A flask of Miruvor, the cordial of Imladris, was given to Gandalf by Elrond when the company set out from Rivendell. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-3. See also The Road Goes Ever On, page 61. End of note. No belt or wallet was among the gear discarded by Isildur. Long afterwards, as the Third Age of the Elvish world waned and the War of the Ring approached, it was revealed to the Council of Elrond that the ring had been found, sunk near the edge of the Glodden fields and close to the western bank, though no trace of Isildur's body was ever discovered. They were also then aware that Saruman had been secretly searching in the same region, but though he had not found the ring, which had long before been carried off, they did not yet know what else he might have discovered. But King Elisar, when he was crowned in Gondor, began the reordering of his realm, and one of his first tasks was the restoration of Orthonk, where he proposed to set up again the Palantir recovered from Saruman. Then all the secrets of the tower were searched. Many things of worth were found, jewels and heirlooms of Eorl filched from Edoras by the agency of Wormtongue during King Theoden's decline, and other such things, more ancient and beautiful, from mounds and tombs far and wide. Saruman in his degradation had become not a dragon, but a jackdaw. At last, behind a hidden door that they could not have found or opened, had not Elisar had the aid of Gimli the dwarf, a steel closet was revealed. Maybe it had been intended to receive the ring, but it was almost bare. In a casket on a high shelf, two things were laid. One was a small case of gold attached to a fine chain. It was empty and bore no letter or token, but beyond all doubt it had once borne the ring about Isildur's neck. Next to it lay a treasure without price, long mourned as lost forever, the Elendilmir itself, the white star of elvish crystal upon a fillet of mithril, that had descended from Silmarion to Elendil and had been taken by him as the token of royalty in the North Kingdom. Note 31. For that medal was found in Numenor. Author's note. In the line of Elros, page 221, Tar-Telamite, the 15th ruler of Numenor, is said to have been called so, that is, silver-handed, because of his love of silver, and he bade his servants to seek ever for Mithril. But Gandalf said that Mithril was found in Moria, alone in the world. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-4. End of note. Note 32. It is told in Aldarion and Arrendis, page 184, that Arrendis caused the diamond which Aldarion brought to her from Middle-earth to be set as a star in a silver fillet, and at her asking he bound it on her forehead. For this reason she was known as Tar Elistirne, the Lady of the Starbrow. And thus came, it is said, the manner of the kings and queens afterward to wear as a star a white jewel upon the brow, and they had no crown. Page 215, note 18. This tradition cannot be unconnected with that of the Elendilmir, a star-like gem borne on the brow as a token of royalty in Arnor. But the original Elendilmir itself, since it belonged to Silmarion, was in existence in Numenor, whatever its origin may have been, before Aldarion brought Arrendis' jewel from Middle-earth, and they cannot be the same. End of note. Every king and the chieftains that followed them in Arnor had borne the Elendilmir, down even to Elisar himself, but though it was a jewel of great beauty, made by elvensmiths in Imladris for Valindil, Isildur's son, it had not the ancientry nor potency of the one that had been lost when Isildur fled into the dark and came back no more. Elessar took it up with reverence, and when he returned to the north and took up again the full kingship of Arnor, Arwen bounded upon his brow, and men were silent in amaze to see its splendor. But Elessar did not again imperil it, and wore it only on high days in the North Kingdom. Otherwise, when in kingly raiment, he bore the Elendilmir which had descended to him. "And this also is a thing of reverence," he said, "and above my worth. 40 heads have worn it before." Note 33. The actual number was 38, since the second Elendilmir was made for Valindil. Compare note 26 above. In the Tale of Years, in Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings, the entry for the year 16 of the Fourth Age, given under Shire Reckoning 1436, states that when King Elessar came to the Brandywine Bridge to greet his friends, he gave the Star of the Dunedain to Master Samwise, while his daughter, Elanor, was made a maid of honor to Queen Arwen. On the basis of this record, Mr. Robert Foster says, in The Complete Guide to Middle-earth, that the Star of Elendil was worn on the brow of the kings of the North Kingdom until Elessar gave it to Sam Gamgee in Fourth Age 16. The clear implication of the present passage is that King Elessar retained indefinitely the Elendilmir that was made for Valindil, and it seems to me in any case out of the question that he would have made a gift of it to the mayor of the Shire, however greatly he esteemed him. The Elendilmir is called by several names, the Star of Elendil, the Star of the North, the Star of the North Kingdom, and the Star of the Dunedain, occurring only in this entry in the Tale of Years, is assumed to be yet another, both in Robert Foster's Guide and in J.E.A. Tyler's Tolkien Companion. I have found no other reference to it, but it seems to me to be almost certain that it was not, and that Master Samwise received some different and more suitable distinction. End of note. When men considered this secret hoard more closely, they were dismayed, for it seemed to them that these things, and certainly the Elendilmir, could not have been found unless they had been upon Isildur's body when he sank. But if that had been in deep water of strong flow, they would in time have been swept far away. Therefore Isildur must have fallen not into the deep stream, but into shallow water, no more than shoulder high. Why then, though an age had passed, were there no traces of his bones? Had Saruman found them, and scorned them, burned them with dishonor in one of his furnaces? If that were so, it was a shameful deed, but not his worst. Appendix. Numenorean Linear Measures. Editor. A note associated with the passage in The Disaster of the Gloddenfields concerning the different routes from Osgiliath to Imladris, pages 271 and 278, note 6, runs as follows. Author. Measures of distance are converted as nearly as possible into modern terms. League is used because it was the longest measurement of distance. In Numenorean reckoning, which was decimal, 5,000 rungar, full paces, made a lar, which was very nearly 3 of our miles. Lar meant pause, because except in forced marches, a brief halt was usually made after this distance had been covered. See note 9 above. The Numenorean Ranga was slightly longer than our yard, approximately 38 inches, owing to their greater stature. Therefore, 5,000 Rangar would be almost exactly the equivalent of 5,280 yards, our league. 5,277 yards, 2 feet and 4 inches, supposing the equivalence to be exact. This cannot be determined, being based on the lengths given in histories of various things, and distances that can be compared with those of our time. Account has to be taken both of the great stature of the Numenoreans, since hands, feet, fingers, and paces are likely to be the origin of names of units of length, and also of the variations from these averages or norms in the process of fixing and organizing a measurement system both for daily use and for exact calculations. Thus, 2 rungar was often called man-high, which at 38 inches gives an average height of 6 feet 4 inches. But this was at a later date, when the stature of the Dunedain appears to have decreased, and also was not intended to be an accurate statement of the observed average of male stature among them, but was an approximate length expressed in the well-known unit, ranga. The ranga is often said to have been the length of the stride, from rear heel to front toe, of a full-grown man marching swiftly but at ease. A full stride might be well nigh a ranga and a half. It is, however, said of the great people of the past that they were more than man-high. Elendil was said to be more than man-high by nearly half a ranga, but he was accounted the tallest of all the Numenoreans who escaped the downfall, and was indeed generally known as Elendil the Tall. The Eldar of the Elder Days were also very tall. Galadriel, the tallest of all the women of the Eldar of whom tales tell, was said to be man-high, but it is noted, according to the measure of the Dunedain and the men of old, indicating a height of about 6 feet 4 inches. The Rohirrim were generally shorter, for in their far-off ancestry they had been mingled with men of broader and heavier build. Éomer was said to have been tall, of like height with Aragorn, but he, with other descendants of King Thingel, were taller than the norm of Rohan, deriving this characteristic, together in some cases with darker hair, from Morwen, Thengel's wife, a lady of Gondor of high Numenorean descent. Editor, a note to the foregoing text adds some information concerning Morwen to what is given in The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 2, The Kings of the Mark. Author, she was known as Morwen of Lossarnoch, for she dwelt there, but she did not belong to the people of that land. Her father had removed thither for love of its flowering vales from Belfalis. He was a descendant of a former prince of that fief, and thus a kinsman of Prince Imrahil. His kinship with Éomer of Rohan, though distant, was recognized by Imrahil, and great friendship grew between them. Éomer wedded Imrahil's daughter, Lothario, and their son, Elfwine the Fair, had a striking likeness to his mother's father. Editor, another note remarks of Celeborn that he was a Linda of Valinor, that is, one of the Teleri, whose own name for themselves was Lindar, the singers, and that, author, he was held by them to be tall, as his name indicated, silver tall, but the Teleri were in general somewhat less in build and stature than the Noldor. Editor, this is the late version of the story of Celeborn's origin and of the meaning of his name. See pages 233 and 266. In another place, my father wrote of hobbit stature in relation to that of the Numenoreans and of the origin of the name Halflings. Author, the remarks on the stature of hobbits in the prologue to The Lord of the Rings are unnecessarily vague and complicated, owing to the inclusion of references to survivals of the race in later times. But as far as The Lord of the Rings is concerned, they boil down to this. The hobbits of the Shire were in height between 3 and 4 feet, never less, and seldom more. They did not, of course, call themselves halflings. This was the Numenorean name for them. It evidently referred to their height in comparison with Numenorean men, and was approximately accurate when given. It was applied first to the Harfoots, who became known to the rulers of Arnor in the 11th century. Compare the entry for 1050 in the Tale of Years, and then later also to fallowhides and stores. The kingdoms of the north and south remained in close communication at that time, and indeed until much later, and each was well informed of all events in the other region, especially of the migration of peoples of all kinds. Thus, though no halfling, so far as is known, had ever actually appeared in Gondor before Peregrin took, the existence of this people within the kingdom of Arthedain was known in Gondor, and they were given the name Halfling, or in Sindarin, Perion. As soon as Frodo was brought to Boromir's notice at the Council of Elrond, he recognized him as a member of this race. He had probably until then regarded them as creatures of what we should call fairy tales, or folklore. It seems plain from Pippin's reception in Gondor that, in fact, halflings were remembered there. Editor, in another version of this note, more is said of the diminishing stature of both halflings and Numenoreans. Author, the dwindling of the Dunedain was not a normal tendency, shared by peoples whose proper home was Middle-earth, but due to the loss of their ancient land far in the west, nearest of all mortal lands to the Undying Realm. The much later dwindling of hobbits must be due to a change in their state and way of life. They became a fugitive and secret people, driven, as men, the big folk, became more and more numerous, usurping the more fertile and habitable lands, to refuge in forest or wilderness, a wandering and poor folk, forgetful of their arts, living a precarious life, absorbed in the search for food and fearful of being seen. 2. Cirion and Eor and the Friendship of Gondor and Rohan. 1. The Northmen and the Wine Riders. The Chronicle of Cirion and Eor begins only with the first meeting of Cirion, steward of Gondor, and Eor, lord of the Eotheod, after the Battle of the Field of Celebrant was over and the invaders of Gondor destroyed. Note 1. No writing is extant with this title, but no doubt the narrative given in the third section, Cirion and Eor, page 300, represents a part of it. End of note. But there were lays and legends of the great ride of the Rohirrim from the north, both in Rohan and in Gondor, from which accounts that appear in later chronicles, together with much other matter concerning the Eotheod, were taken. Note 2. Such as the Book of the Kings. Author's note. This work was referred to in the opening passage of Appendix A to The Lord of the Rings, as being, with the Book of the Stewards and the Akalabeth, among the records of Gondor that were opened to Frodo and Peregrin by King Elisar. But in the revised edition, the reference was removed. End of note. These are here drawn together briefly in chronicle form. The Eotheod were first known by that name in the days of King Calimetar of Gondor, who died in the year 1936 of the Third Age, at which time they were a small people living in the vales of Anduin, between the Carrick and the Gladden fields, for the most part on the west side of the river. They were a remnant of the Northmen, who had formerly been a numerous and powerful confederation of peoples living in the wide plains between Mirkwood and the River Running, great breeders of horses, and riders renowned for their skill and endurance, though their settled homes were in the eaves of the forest, and especially in the East Bight, which had largely been made by their felling of trees. Note 3. The East Bight, not named elsewhere, was the great indentation in the eastern border of Mirkwood, seen in the map to the Lord of the Rings. End of note. These Northmen were descendants of the same race of men as those who in the First Age passed into the west of Middle-earth and became the allies of the Eldar in their wars with Morgoth. Note 4. The Northmen appear to have been most nearly akin to the third and greatest of the peoples of the Elfrens, ruled by the House of Hador. Author's note. End of note. They were, therefore, from afar off kinsmen of the Dunedain, or Numenoreans, and there was great friendship between them and the people of Gondor. They were, in fact, a bulwark of Gondor, keeping its northern and eastern frontiers from invasion, though that was not fully realized by the kings until the bulwark was weakened and at last destroyed. The waning of the Northmen of Rovanion began with a great plague, which appeared there in the winter of the year 1635 and soon spread to Gondor. In Gondor the mortality was great, especially among those who dwelt in cities. It was greater in Rovanion, for though its people lived mostly in the open and had no great cities, the plague came with a cold winter when horses and men were driven into shelter and their low wooden houses and stables were thronged. Moreover, they were little skilled in the arts of healing and medicine, of which much was still known in Gondor, preserved from the wisdom of Numenor. When the plague passed, it is said that more than half of the folk of Rovanion had perished, and of their horses also. They were slow to recover, but their weakness was not tested for a long time. No doubt the peoples further east had been equally afflicted, so that the enemies of Gondor came chiefly from the south or oversea. But when the invasions of the Wine Riders began and involved Gondor in wars that lasted for almost 100 years, the Northmen bore the brunt of the first assaults. King Narmakil II took a great army north into the plains south of Mirkwood and gathered all that he could of the scattered remnants of the Northmen, but he was defeated and himself fell in battle. The remnant of his army retreated over the Dagorlad into Ithilien, and Gondor abandoned all lands east of the Anduin, save Ithilien. Note 5. The escape of the army of Gondor from total destruction was in part due to the courage and loyalty of the horsemen of the Northmen under Marhari, a descendant of Vidugavia, king of Rovanion, who acted as rear guard. But the forces of Gondor had inflicted such losses on the Wine Riders that they had not strength enough to press their invasion until reinforced from the east, and were content for the time to complete their conquest of Rovanion. Author's note. It is told in Appendix A, 1-4, to The Lord of the Rings, that Vidugavia, who called himself King of Rovanion, was the most powerful of the princes of the Northmen. He was shown favor by Romendakiel II, King of Gondor, died 1366, whom he had aided in war against the Easterlings, and the marriage of Romendakiel's son, Valakar, to Vidugavia's daughter, Vidumavi, led to the destructive kin strife in Gondor in the 15th century. End of note. As for the Northmen, a few, it is said, fled over the Kelduin, river running, and were merged with the folk of Dale under Erebor, with whom they were akin. Some took refuge in Gondor, and others were gathered by Marhwini, son of Marhari, who fell in the rearguard action after the Battle of the Plains. Note 6. It is an interesting fact, not referred to, I believe, in any of my father's writings, that the names of the early kings and princes of the Northmen and the Eotheod are Gothic in form, not Old English, Anglo-Saxon, as in the case of Leod, Eorl, and the later Rohirrim. Vidugavia is Latinized in spelling, representing Gothic Widugauja, wood-dweller, a recorded Gothic name, and similarly, Vidumavi, Gothic Widumawi, wood-maiden. Marhwini and Marhari contain the Gothic word mar, horse, corresponding to Old English mir, plural miras, the word used in The Lord of the Rings for the horses of Rohan. Wini, friend, corresponds to Old English winne, seen in the names of several of the kings of the Mark. Since, as is explained in Appendix F2, the language of Rohan was made to resemble ancient English, the names of the ancestors of the Rohirrim are cast into the forms of the earliest recorded Germanic language. End of note. Passing north between Mirkwood and Anduin, they settled in the vales of Anduin, where they were joined by many fugitives who came through the forest. This was the beginning of the Eotheod, though nothing was known of it in Gondor for many years. Note 7. As was the form of the name in later days. Author's note. This is Old English, horse people. See note 36. End of note. Most of the Northmen were reduced to servitude, and all their former lands were occupied by the Wine Riders. Note 8. The foregoing narrative does not contradict the accounts in Appendix A, 1, 4, and 2, to The Lord of the Rings, though it is much briefer. Nothing is said here of the war fought against the Easterlings in the 13th century by Menalcar, who took the name of Romendakiel II. The absorption of many Northmen into the armies of Gondor by that king, or of the marriage of his son Valakar to a princess of the Northmen, and the kin strife of Gondor that resulted from it. But it adds certain features which are not mentioned in The Lord of the Rings. That the waning of the Northmen of Rovanion was due to the Great Plague. That the battle in which King Narmakil II was slain in the year 1856, said in Appendix A to have been beyond Anduin, was in the wide lands south of Mirkwood, and was known as the Battle of the Plains, and that his great army was saved from annihilation by the Wine Riders through the rearguard defense of Marhari, descendant of Vidugavia. It is also made clearer here that it was after the Battle of the Plains that the Eotheod, a remnant of the Northmen, became a distinct people dwelling in the vales of Anduin between the Carrick and the Gladden fields. End of note. But at length, King Calimetar, son of Narmakil II, being free from other dangers, determined to avenge the defeat of the Battle of the Plains. Note 9. His grandfather, Telemetar, had captured Umbar and broken the power of the Corsairs, and the peoples of Harad were at this period engaged in wars and feuds of their own. Author's note. The taking of Umbar by Telemetar Umbardakil was in the year 1810. End of note. Messengers came to him from Marwini, warning him that the wine riders were plotting to raid Kalinarthon over the Undeeps. But they said also that a revolt of the Northmen who had been enslaved was being prepared and would burst into flame if the wine riders became involved in war. Note 10. The great westward bends of the Anduin east of Fangorn Forest. See the first citation given in Appendix C to the History of Galadriel and Celeborn, page 260. End of note. Calimetar, therefore, as soon as he could, led an army out of Ithilien, taking care that its approach should be well known to the enemy. The wine riders came down with all the strength that they could spare, and Calimetar gave way before them, drawing them away from their homes. At length, battle was joined upon the Dagorlad, and the result was long in doubt. But at its height, horsemen that Calimetar had sent over the Undeeps, left unguarded by the enemy, joined with a great Eored, led by Marwini, assailed the wine riders in flank and rear. Note 11. On the word Eored, see note 36. End of note. The victory of Gondor was overwhelming, though not, in the event, decisive. When the enemy broke and were soon in disordered flight north towards their homes, Calimetar wisely, for his part, did not pursue them. They had left well-nigh a third of their host dead to rot upon the Dagorlad among the bones of other and nobler battles of the past. But the horsemen of Marwini harried the fugitives and inflicted great loss upon them in their long rout over the plains until they were within far sight of Mirkwood. There they left them, taunting them. "Fly east, not north, folk of Sauron! See, the homes you stole are in flames!" For there was a great smoke going up. The revolt, planned and assisted by Marwini, had indeed broken out. Desperate outlaws coming out of the forest had roused the slaves, and together had succeeded in burning many of the dwellings of the wine riders, and their storehouses, and their fortified camps of wagons. But most of them had perished in the attempt, for they were ill-armed, and the enemy had not left their homes undefended. Their youths and old men were aided by the younger women, who in that people were also trained in arms, and fought fiercely in defense of their homes and their children. Thus in the end, Marwini was obliged to retire again to his land beside the Anduin, and the Northmen of his race never again returned to their former homes. Calimetar withdrew to Gondor, which enjoyed for a time, from 1899 to 1944, a respite from war before the great assault in which the line of its kings came near to its end. Nonetheless, the alliance of Calimetar and Marwini had not been in vain. If the strength of the wine riders of Rhovanion had not been broken, that assault would have come sooner and in greater force, and the realm of Gondor might have been destroyed. But the greatest effect of the alliance lay far in the future, which none could then foresee. The two great rides of the Rohirrim to the salvation of Gondor, the coming of Eorl to the field of Celebrant, and the horns of King Theoden upon the Pelennor, but for which the return of the king would have been in vain. Note 12. This story is very much fuller than the summary account in Appendix A, 1-4, to The Lord of the Rings. Calimetar, son of Narmakil II, helped by a revolt in Rhovanion, avenged his father with a great victory over the Easterlings upon Dagorlad in 1899, and for a while the peril was averted. End of note. In the meanwhile, the wine riders licked their wounds and plotted their revenge. Beyond the reach of the arms of Gondor, in lands east of the Sea of Rune, from which no tidings came to its kings, their kinsfolk spread and multiplied, and they were eager for conquests and booty, and filled with hatred of Gondor, which stood in their way. It was long, however, before they moved. On the one hand, they feared the might of Gondor, and knowing nothing of what passed west of Anduin, they believed that its realm was larger and more populous than it was in truth at that time. On the other hand, the eastern wine riders had been spreading southward, beyond Mordor, and were in conflict with the peoples of Khand and their neighbors further south. Eventually a peace and alliance was agreed between these enemies of Gondor, and an attack was prepared that should be made at the same time from north and south. Little or nothing, of course, was known of these designs and movements in Gondor. What is here said was deduced from the events long afterwards by historians, to whom it was also clear that the hatred of Gondor and the alliance of its enemies in concerted action, for which they themselves had neither the will nor the wisdom, was due to the machinations of Sauron. Forthwini, son of Marwini, indeed warned King Ondaher, who succeeded his father Calimetar in the year 1936, that the wine riders of Ravanion were recovering from their weakness and fear, and that he suspected that they were receiving new strength from the east, for he was much troubled by raids into the south of his land that came both up the river and through the narrows of the forest. Note 13. The narrows of the forest must refer to the narrow waste of Mirkwood in the south, caused by the indentation of the east bight. See note 3. End of note. But Gondor could do no more at that time than gather and train as great an army as it could find or afford. Thus, when the assault came at last, it did not find Gondor unprepared, though its strength was less than it needed. Ondaher was aware that his southern enemies were preparing for war, and he had the wisdom to divide his forces into a northern army and a southern. The latter was the smaller, for the danger from that quarter was held to be less. Note 14. Justly, for an attack proceeding from near Harad, unless it had assistance from Umbar, which was not at that time available, could more easily be resisted and contained. It could not cross the Anduin, and as it went north, passed into a narrowing land between the river and the mountains. Author's note. End of note. It was under the command of Earnu, a member of the royal house, being a descendant of King Telemetar, father of Narmakil II. His base was at Pelargir. The northern army was commanded by King Ondaher himself. This had always been the custom of Gondor, that the king, if he willed, should command his army in a major battle, provided that an heir with undisputed claim to the throne was left behind. Ondaher came of a warlike line, and was loved and esteemed by his army, and he had two sons, both of age to bear arms, Artemir, the elder, and Faramir, some 3 years younger. News of the oncoming of the enemy reached Pelargir on the 9th day of Kermie in the year 1944. Earnu had already made his dispositions. He had crossed the Anduin with half his force, and leaving by design the fords of the Poros undefended, had encamped some 40 miles north in South Ithilien. King Ondaher had purposed to lead his host north through Ithilien and deploy it on the Dagorlad, a field of ill omen for the enemies of Gondor. At that time, the forts upon the line of the Anduin north of Sarn Gebir that had been built by Narmakil I were still in repair and manned by sufficient soldiers from Cullenarthon to prevent any attempt of an enemy to cross the river at the Undeeps. But the news of the northern assault did not reach Ondaher until the morning of the 12th day of Kermie, by which time the enemy was already drawing near, whereas the army of Gondor had been moving more slowly than it would be if Ondaher had received earlier warning, and its vanguard had not yet reached the gates of Mordor. The main force was leading with the king and his guards, followed by the soldiers of the right wing and the left wing, which would take up their places when they passed out of Ithilien and approached the Dagorlad. There they expected the assault to come from the north, or northeast, as it had before in the Battle of the Plains, and in the victory of Calimetar on the Dagorlad. But it was not so. The wine riders had mustered a great host by the southern shores of the inland sea of Rûn, strengthened by men of their kinsfolk in Ravanion and from their new allies in Khand. When all was ready, they set out for Gondor from the east, moving with all the speed they could along the line of the arid Lithwi, where their approach was not observed until too late. So it came to pass that the head of the army of Gondor had only drawn level with the gates of Mordor, the Morannon, when a great dust borne on a wind from the east announced the oncoming of the enemy vanguard. Note 15. An isolated note associated with the text remarks that at this period the Morannon was still in the control of Gondor, and the two watchtowers east and west of it, the Towers of the Teeth, were still manned. The road through Ithilien was still in full repair as far as the Morannon, and there it met a road going north towards the Dagorlad, and another going east along the line of arid Lithwi. Neither of these roads is marked on the maps to the Lord of the Rings. The eastward road extended to a point north of the site of Barad-dûr. It had never been completed further, and what had been made was now long neglected. Nonetheless, its first 50 miles, which had once been fully constructed, greatly speeded the wine rider's approach. End of note. This was composed not only of the war chariots of the wine riders, but also of a force of cavalry far greater than any that had been expected. Andaher had only time to turn and face the assault with his right flank close to the Morannon and to send word to Minotaur, captain of the right wing behind, to cover his left flank as swiftly as he could when the chariots and horsemen crashed into his disordered line. Of the confusion of the disaster that followed, few clear reports were ever brought to Gondor. Andaher was utterly unprepared to meet a charge of horsemen and chariots in great weight. With his guard and his banner, he had hastily taken up a position on a low knoll, but this was of no avail. Note 16. Historians surmised that it was the same hill as that upon which King Elisar made his stand in the last battle against Sauron, with which the Third Age ended. But if so, it was still only a natural upswelling that offered little obstacle to horsemen, and had not yet been piled up by the labor of orcs. Author's note. The passages in The Return of the King, 5:10, here referred to, tell that Aragorn now set the host in such array as could best be contrived, and they were drawn up on two great hills of blasted stone and earth that orcs had piled in years of labor, and that Aragorn, with Gandalf, stood on the one while the banners of Rohan and Dol Amroth were raised on the other. End of note. The main charge was hurled against his banner, and it was captured. His guard was almost annihilated, and he himself was slain, and his son Artemir at his side. Their bodies were never recovered. The assault of the enemy passed over them and about both sides of the knoll, driving deep into the disordered ranks of Gondor, hurling them back in confusion upon those behind, and scattering and pursuing many others westward into the dead marshes. Minotaur took command. He was a man both valiant and war-wise. The first fury of the onslaught was spent, with far less loss and greater success than the enemy had looked for. The cavalry and chariots now withdrew, for the main host of the wine riders was approaching. In such time as he had, Minotaur, raising his own banner, rallied the remaining men of the center and those of his own command that were at hand. He at once sent messengers to Adrahil of Dol Amroth, the captain of the left wing, commanding him to withdraw with all the speed he could both his own command and those at the rear of the right wing who had not yet been engaged. Note 17. On the presence of Adrahil of Dol Amroth, see Note 39. End of note. With these forces, he was to take up a defensive position between Cair Andros, which was manned, and the mountains of Ephelduoth, where, owing to the great eastward loop of the Anduin, the land was at its narrowest, to cover as long as he could the approaches to Minas Tirith. Minotaur himself, to allow time for this retreat, would form a rear guard and attempt to stem the advance of the main host of the wine riders. Adrahil should at once send messengers to find Eärnil, if they could, and inform him of the disaster of the Morannon and of the position of the retreating northern army. When the main host of the wine riders advanced to the attack, it was then 2 hours after noon, and Minotaur had withdrawn his line to the head of the great north road of Ithilien, half a mile beyond the point where it turned east to the watchtowers of the Morannon. The first triumph of the wine riders was now the beginning of their undoing. Ignorant of the numbers and ordering of the defending army, they had launched their first onslaught too soon, before the greater part of that army had come out of the narrow land of Ithilien, and the charge of their chariots and cavalry had met with a success far swifter and more overwhelming than they had expected. Their main onslaught was then too long delayed, and they could no longer use their greater numbers with full effect, according to the tactics they had intended, being accustomed to warfare in open lands. It may well be supposed that, elated by the fall of the king and the rout of a large part of the opposing center, they believed that they had already overthrown the defending army, and that their own main army had little more to do than advance to the invasion and occupation of Gondor. If that were so, they were deceived. The wine riders came on in little order, still exultant and singing songs of victory, seeing as yet no signs of any defenders to oppose them. Until they found that the road into Gondor turned south into a narrow land of trees under the shadow of the dark Ephelduoth, where an army could march or ride in good order only down a great highway. Before them, it ran on through a deep cutting. Editor. Here the text abruptly breaks off, and the notes and jottings for its continuation are for the most part illegible. It is possible to make out, however, that the men of the Eotheod fought with Ondaher, and also that Ondaher's second son, Faramir, was ordered to remain in Minas Tirith as regent. For it was not permitted by the law that both his sons should go into battle at the same time. A similar observation is made earlier in the narrative, page 291. But Faramir did not do so. He went to the war in disguise and was slain. The writing is here almost impossible to decipher, but it seems that Faramir joined the Eotheod and was caught with a party of them as they retreated towards the Dead Marshes. The leader of the Eotheod, whose name is indecipherable after the first element, Mar, came to their rescue, but Faramir died in his arms, and it was only when he searched his body that he found tokens that showed that he was the prince. The leader of the Eotheod then went to join Minotaur at the head of the North Road in Ithilien, who at that very moment was giving an order for a message to be taken to the prince in Minas Tirith, who was now the king. It was then that the leader of the Eotheod gave him the news that the prince had gone disguised to the battle and had been slain. The presence of the Eotheod and the part played by their leader may explain the inclusion in this narrative, ostensibly to be an account of the beginnings of the friendship of Gondor and the Rohirrim, of this elaborate story of the battle between the army of Gondor and the wine riders. The concluding passage of the fully written text gives the impression that the host of the wine riders were about to receive a check to their exaltation and elation as they came down the highway into the deep cutting. But the notes at the end show that they were not long held up by the rearguard defense of Minotaur. The wine riders poured relentlessly into Ithilien, and, late on the 13th day of Kermie, they overwhelmed Minotaur, who was slain by an arrow. He is here said to have been King Ondaher's sister son. His men carried him out of the fray, and all that remained of the rear guard fled southwards to find Adrahil. The chief commander of the wine riders then called a halt to the advance and held a feast. Nothing more can be made out, but the brief account at Appendix A to The Lord of the Rings tells how Aarnu came up from the south and routed them. Author. In 1944, King Ondaher and both his sons, Artemir and Faramir, fell in battle north of the Morannon, and the enemy poured into Ithilien. But Aarnu, captain of the southern army, won a great victory in south Ithilien and destroyed the army of Harad that had crossed the river Poros. Hastening north, he gathered to him all that he could of the retreating northern army and came up against the main camp of the wine riders while they were feasting and reveling, believing that Gondor was overthrown and that nothing remained but to take the spoil. Aarnil stormed the camp and set fire to the wines and drove the enemy in a great rout out of Ithilien. A great part of those who fled before him perished in the Dead Marshes. Editor. In the Tale of Years, the victory of Aarnil is called the Battle of the Camp. After the deaths of Ondaher and both his sons at the Morannon, Arvedui, last king of the Northern Realm, laid claim to the crown of Gondor, but his claim was rejected, and in the year following the Battle of the Camp, Aarnil became king. His son was Aarnir, who died in Minas Morgul after accepting the challenge of the Lord of the Nazgûl and was the last of the kings of the Southern Realm. 2. The Ride of Eorl. Author. While the Eotheod still dwelt in their former home, they were well known to Gondor as a people of good trust, from whom they received news of all that passed in that region. Note 18. Their former home, in the Vales of Anduin between the Carrick and the Gladden Fields. See page 289. End of note. They were a remnant of the Northmen, who were held to be akin in ages past to the Dunedain, and in the days of the great kings had been their allies and contributed much of their blood to the people of Gondor. It was thus of great concern to Gondor when the Eotheod removed into the far north in the days of Aarnil II, last but one of the kings of the Southern Realm. Note 19. The cause of the northward migration of the Eotheod is given in Appendix A, 2, to The Lord of the Rings. The forefathers of Eorl loved best the plains, and delighted in horses and all feats of horsemanship. But there were many men in the middle vales of Anduin in those days, and moreover, the shadow of Dol Guldur was lengthening, when therefore they heard of the overthrow of the Witch-King. In the year 1975, they sought more room in the north, and drove away the remnants of the people of Angmar on the east side of the mountains. But in the days of Leod, father of Eorl, they had grown to be a numerous people, and were again somewhat straitened in the land of their home. The leader of the migration of the Eotheod was named Frumgar, and in the Tale of Years its date is given as 1977. End of note. The new land of the Eotheod lay north of Mirkwood, between the Misty Mountains westward and the Forest River eastward. Southward, it extended to the confluence of the two short rivers that they named Graylin and Longwell. Graylin flowed down from arid Mithrin, the Grey Mountains, but Longwell came from the Misty Mountains, and this name it bore because it was the source of Anduin, which from its junction with Graylin they called Longflood. Note 20. These rivers, unnamed, are marked on the map to the Lord of the Rings. The Graylin is there shown as having two tributary branches. End of note. Messengers still passed between Gondor and the Eotheod after their departure, but it was some 450 of our miles between the confluence of Graylin and Longwell, where was their only fortified burg, and the inflow of Limlight into Anduin in a direct line as a bird might fly, and much more for those who journeyed on earth. And in like manner, some 800 miles to Minas Tirith. The Chronicle of Cirion and Eorl reports no events before the Battle of the Field of Celebrant, but from other sources they may be made out to have been of this sort. The wide lands south of Mirkwood, from the Brown Lands to the Sea of Rune, which offered no obstacle to invaders from the east until they came to Anduin, were a chief source of concern and unease to the rulers of Gondor. But during the watchful peace, the forts along the Anduin, especially on the west shore of the Undeeps, had been unmanned and neglected. Note 21. The watchful peace lasted from the years 2063 to 2460, when Sauron was absent from Dol Guldur. End of note. Note 22. For the forts along the Anduin, see page 292, and for the Undeeps, page 260. End of note. After that time, Gondor was assailed both by orcs out of Mordor, which had long been unguarded, and by the corsairs of Umbar, and had neither men nor opportunity for manning the line of Anduin, north of the Emyn Muil. Cirion became steward of Gondor in the year 2489. The menace from the north was ever in his mind, and he gave much thought to ways that might be devised against the threat of invasion from that quarter, as the strength of Gondor diminished. He put a few men into the old forts to keep watch on the Undeeps, and sent scouts and spies into the lands between Mirkwood and Dagorlad. He was thus soon aware that new and dangerous enemies coming out of the east were steadily drifting in from beyond the Sea of Rune. They were slaying, or driving north up the river running and into the forest, the remnant of the Northmen, friends of Gondor that still dwelt east of Mirkwood. Note 23. From an earlier passage in this text, page 290, one gains the impression that there were no Northmen left in the lands east of Mirkwood after the victory of Calumetar over the wine riders on the Dagorlad in the year 1899. End of note. But he could do nothing to aid them, and it became more and more dangerous to gather news. Too many of his scouts never returned. It was thus not until the winter of the year 2509 was past that Cirion became aware that a great movement against Gondor was being prepared. Hosts of men were mustering all along the southern eaves of Mirkwood. They were only rudely armed, and had no great number of horses for riding, using horses mainly for draft, since they had many large wines, as had the wine riders, to whom they were no doubt akin, that assailed Gondor in the last days of the kings. But what they lacked in gear of war, they made up in numbers, so far as could be guessed. In this peril, Cirion's thought turned at last in desperation to the Eotheod, and he determined to send messengers to them. But they would have to go through Cullinarthon and over the Undeeps, and then through lands already watched and patrolled by the Balkhoth, before they could reach the Vales of Anduin. Note 24. So these people were then called in Gondor, a mixed word of popular speech, from Westron, Balk, horrible, and Sindarin, Hoth, horde, applied to such peoples as the Orcs. Author's note. See the entry Hoth in the appendix to the Silmarillion. End of note. This would mean a ride of some 450 miles to the Undeeps, and more than 500 thence to the Ea Theod, and from the Undeeps they would be forced to go warily, and mostly by night, until they had passed the shadow of Dol Guldur. Cirion had little hope that any of them would get through. He called for volunteers, and choosing 6 riders of great courage and endurance, he sent them out in pairs with a day's interval between them. Each bore a message, learned by heart, and also a small stone incised with the seal of the stewards that he should deliver to the lord of the Ea Theod in person, if he succeeded in reaching that land. Note 25. The letters R, N-D, R, surmounted by 3 stars, signifying Arandar, king's servant, steward. Author's note. End of note. The message was addressed to Eorl, son of Laod, for Cirion knew that he had succeeded his father some years before, when he was but a youth of 16, and though now no more than 25, was praised in all such tidings as reached Gondor as a man of great courage and wise beyond his years. Yet Cirion had but faint hope that even if the message were received, it would be answered. He had no claim on the Ea Theod beyond their ancient friendship with Gondor to bring them from so far away with any strength that would avail. The tidings that the Balkhoth were destroying the last of their kin in the south, if they did not know it already, might give weight to his appeal, if the Ea Theod themselves were not threatened by any attack. Cirion said no more, and ordered what strength he had to meet the storm. Note 26. He did not speak of the thought that he had also in mind, that the Ea Theod were, as he had learned, restless, finding their northern lands too narrow and infertile to support their numbers, which had much increased. Author's note. End of note. He gathered as great a force as he could, and taking command of it himself, made ready as swiftly as might be to lead it north to Cullinarthon. Halas, his son, he left in command at Minas Tirith. The first pair of messengers left on the 10th day of Suleme, and in the event it was one of these, alone of all the 6, who got through to the Ea Theod. He was Barondir, a great rider of a family that claimed descent from a captain of the Northmen in the service of the kings of old. Note 27. His name was long remembered in the song of Rohan Methesto, Rider of the Last Hope, as Barondir Udalroth, Barondir the Stirrupless, for he rode back with the Eahare at the right hand of Eorl, and was the first to cross the Limlight and cleave a path to the aid of Cirion. He fell at last on the field of Celebrant, defending his lord, to the great grief of Gondor and the Ea Theod, and was afterwards laid in tomb in the hallows of Minas Tirith. Author's note. End of note. Of the others, no tidings were ever heard, save of Barondir's companion. He was slain by arrows in ambush as they passed near Dol Guldur, from which Barondir escaped by fortune and the speed of his horse. He was pursued as far north as the Gladenfields, and often waylaid by men that came out of the forest and forced him to ride far out of the direct way. He came at last to the Ea Theod after 15 days, for the last 2 without food, and he was so spent that he could scarce speak his message to Eorl. It was then the 25th day of Suleme. Eorl took counsel with himself, in silence, but not for long. Soon he rose, and he said, "I will come. If the Mundberg falls, whither shall we flee from the darkness?" Then he took Barondir's hand in token of his promise. Eorl at once summoned his council of elders and began to prepare for the great riding. But this took many days, for the host had to be gathered and mustered, and thought taken for the ordering of the people and the defense of the land. At that time, the Aetheod were at peace and had no fear of war, though it might prove otherwise when it became known that their lord had ridden away to battle far off in the south. Nonetheless, Errol saw well that nothing less than his full strength would serve, and he must risk all or draw back and break his promise. At last the whole host was assembled, and only a few hundreds were left behind to support the men unfitted for such a desperate venture by youth or age. It was then the sixth day of the month of Eresse. On that day, in silence, the great Eohere set out, leaving fear behind, and taking with them small hope, for they knew not what lay before them, either on the road or at its end. It is said that Eor led forth some 7,000 fully armed riders and some hundreds of horsed archers. At his right hand rode Barondir to serve as guide so far as he might, since he had lately passed through the lands. But this great host was not threatened or assailed during its long journey down the vales of Anduin. Such folk of good or evil kind as saw it approach fled out of its path for fear of its might and splendor. As it drew southward and passed by southern Mirkwood, below the great east bight, which was now infested by the Balchoth, still there was no sign of men, in force or in scouting parties, to bar their road or to spy upon their coming. In part this was due to events unknown to them, which had come to pass since Barondir set out. But other powers also were at work. For when at last the host drew near to Dol Guldur, Errol turned away westward for fear of the dark shadow and cloud that flowed out from it. And then he rode on within sight of Anduin. Many of the riders turned their eyes thither, half in fear and half in hope, to glimpse from afar the shimmer of the Dwemordine, the perilous land that in legends of their people was said to shine like gold in the springtime. But now it seemed shrouded in a gleaming mist, and to their dismay the mist passed over the river and flowed over the land before them. Errol did not halt. "Ride on!" he commanded.